Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, March 10th. Let the record reflect the time is 3:15 p.m. Today we have present Representative Sadler, Representative Wright, Representative Carrick, and myself, Chair Sumner. The staff that will be assisting us today are Jordan Wright with House Records, Zachary Lawhorn with the LIO, and my staff, Clark Bickford, Committee Aide to House Labor and Commerce. Today we're going to start by letting Sylvan Robb, Director of CBPL, finish her bill presentation from Wednesday on HB 85 that was cut short. Please approach the table and finish your sectional analysis. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Sylvan Robb, the Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing at the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. So the sectional analysis for HB 85, Section 1 repeals and reenacts AS 0801062 temporary license to allow the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development to issue a temporary license if the applicant is licensed in another U.S. jurisdiction or province or territory of Canada that has license requirements substantially equivalent or greater than Alaska's, or authorizes a scope of practice substantially equivalent to the scope of practice for the license in Alaska, meets the qualifications and requirements of a license in Alaska and resides in a U.S. jurisdiction or province or territory of Canada that does not license the respective profession, or meets the qualifications and requirements for the Alaska license through military education, training, and service under AS 0801064, subsection A, and doesn't already hold a license in another jurisdiction. Section 1 also states that to qualify for a temporary license, the applicant cannot be the subject of disciplinary action related to the profession in another jurisdiction, or be the subject of an ongoing review or disciplinary proceeding by the profession's licensing entity in another jurisdiction. They also cannot have committed an act in another jurisdiction within the 10 years before the application that would have constituted grounds for denial or revocation of a license in Alaska at the time the act was committed. And finally, Section 1 states that to qualify for a temporary license, the applicant must pay all required fees, undergo a criminal history background check if the department or applicable board requires such for the professional license. The temporary licenses are valid for up to 180 days. Applicants can apply for one 180-day extension, and those will be approved at the department's discretion. Temporary license holders are authorized to temporarily practice the profession for which the license was granted. The department has the authority to revoke a license issued under this section if the license was secured under deceit, fraud, or intentional misrepresentation. Temporary license provisions under this section do not apply to AS 0848, the Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors and Landscape Architects, AS 0854, Big Game Guides and Related Occupations, or AS 0862, Marine Pilots. Section 2 amends AS 0801063, subsection A, under military courtesy licenses to change the term temporary courtesy license to temporary military courtesy license and to refer to a license or certificate versus just a license. And Mr. Chair, sections 3 through 27 are conforming edits. So with your permission, I will skip to section 28.
Please. Thank you.
Section 28 adds a transition regulations section under the uncodified law to allow Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development to adopt regulations necessary to implement the changes made by this act. Section 29 adds a transition savings clause section under uncodified law to provide for litigation, hearings, investigations, appeals, and other proceedings pending under a law amended or repealed by this act to continue and be completed notwithstanding a transfer or amendment or appeal provided in the act. Also allows certificates, orders, permits, licenses, and regulations issued or adopted under the authority of a law amended or repealed by this act to remain in effect for the term issued or until revoked, vacated, or otherwise modified under the act's provisions. And finally, allows contracts, rights, liabilities, and obligations created by or under a law amended or repealed by this act and in effect as of the date of this act to remain in effect. Section 30 provides for an immediate effective date for Sections 28 and 29. And finally, Section 31 provides for a July 1st, 2024 effective date for Sections 1 through 27.
Thank you. And let the record reflect that Representative Prox joined us at 3:16 p.m. Are there any questions for Mrs. Robb? Questions? So I guess I have a question. I assume that the rationale behind this was that we have a significant backlog in licensure. So how are we to be certain that there won't then be a significant backlog in temporary licensure as well as a significant backlog in licensure?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question, and that's certainly a very fair question. So part of the way that this will help the division is that this allows us to not receive two applications from many individuals who are applying for a temporary license and a permanent license. So the temporary license would sort of be a stop on the way to permanent licensure. So that will reduce the volume of applications coming through the division, which will help us. Additionally, we do anticipate, because there are fewer requirements to obtain the temporary license, that people will be able to obtain those more quickly and thus get to work.
And how long is the backlog approximately? Or what would you say the worst backlog length is for one of these licenses?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate the amendment to your question, because the length of time it takes to obtain the various licenses varies greatly by the program. So some programs have very limited requirements, and the amount of documentation that's required is not voluminous, and so it's relatively easy to get those licenses processed and out the door. Whereas for others, we have a really high volume and a high level of documentation and checking that's required. For some licenses, those get turned around very quickly within a couple weeks, but then we have others. Nursing is probably our longest wait at this point, and it's 11 or 12 weeks before we do the initial review on someone's application, which we would agree is a very long time.
Representative Seiler.
Thank you. To the chair, Ms. Ralph, I think I heard you saying that a significant portion of the backlog is due to duplicate applications in the same applicant looking for both permanent and temporary licenses, if I understood you correctly. And if so, wouldn't a simple unique identifier on the applications be enough to let you screen out the duplicates?
Through the chair to Representative Seiler, the chair's question, as I understood it, was about why we thought this would improve processing times. A lot of what's contributed to our current processing times is that we've had substantial staff vacancies and turnover within the division. So at the highest point during the pandemic, we were over 35% vacancy with our professional licensing team. And so we have done made a ton of progress in terms of getting staff hired. Today, we're at 12% vacancy, but there's still a pretty steep learning curve for those new folks as we hire them. So, you know, some of these programs have upwards of 60 pages of regulations in order to issue a license. And so it just takes a while for new staff to get familiar with that so that they can expeditiously go through license applications.
Well, then through the chair again, if I may follow up. So it may appear, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the problem here is training and staffing, not so much the temporary versus permanent licensure. Am I missing the point of the bill?
Through the chair to Representative Seiler, the division is certainly excited about the bill because we feel it's one more tool in our toolbox to improve our licensing capacity. But this does allow us to get people to work more quickly, which certainly if we had no backlog, we wouldn't need to solve that problem. But it also offers the temporary license option for many of our professions that are licensed by the division, which do not currently offer a temporary license option.
If I may, another question on a related topic on the bill. What assurance through the chair, Ms. Rob, can you give us that licenses issued on a temporary basis would receive the same degree of scrutiny, and that the Alaskans receiving professional services from such licensees would have the same level and quality of service that they would if the licensee were a permanent licensee?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I appreciate the question because the foremost part of CBPL's mission is to protect the public. And that's why, you know, we have licensed professionals, because we want to ensure that people who are in professions where there's the opportunity for harm have the necessary qualifications and skills to provide those services safely. We feel confident that this bill would have safe people practicing, because again, in order to get one of these temporary licenses, the license that they're using to apply from that other jurisdiction needs to have substantially similar requirements. So essentially, they could probably meet the requirements here in Alaska to obtain a permanent license. They must have a license in good standing, so they can have had no discipline against their license, and they cannot be in the middle of a disciplinary investigation in that other jurisdiction. And then finally, you can't have committed an act in the previous 10 years that would prevent you from obtaining a license in Alaska.
And just a follow, just comment, and I'll stop. Actually, I can conceive that there might be a bit of a learning curve where the examiners would find out whether a teacher's license or from state X, you might get a lot of those, you might go through an awful lot of substantially similar analysis work in the first one, but the subsequent applicants would know that's good to go. So it might go a little bit slower at first, but faster at the end.
Mr. Chair, if I may just provide one point of clarification, Representative Sadler, teacher certification is done by the Department of Education. So.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair, Ms. Robb. This is maybe getting a little in the weeds, but I'm noticing that just in some of that conforming language in the sectional, it looks like veterinarians and naturopaths currently have to work under a licensed veterinarian or naturopath with their temporary license, but I'm not seeing similar language for, say, physical therapists or nurses or dentists, dentistry. So I'm just wondering if you have any information on why it is that, if this is true, why a veterinarian, it looks like it was existing language, why there's maybe certain licenses that have to work under the supervision of a permanent licensee while maybe other medical professions don't, or if that's even the case, I might be misreading it.
Through the chair to Representative Carrick, the requirements for licensees for all of those programs that have boards are set by that regulatory board. And so it's the professionals who work in that field who have deemed what the necessary qualifications are. And so as somebody's coming in, what they're comfortable with.
So just a follow-up through the chair. So in other words, the Board of Naturopaths and Veterinarians have these requirements while the Board of Nursing doesn't. Is there anything that prevents the Board of Nursing from creating a similar change to say that a temporary licensee must work under the direction of a permanent licensed nurse?
Through the chair to Representative Carrick, just one point of clarification, there is no board for naturopaths, so that's one of the 20-some professions we have that do not have a regulatory board. As to your specific question about, for example, the Board of Nursing, off the top of my head, I couldn't say if their statutes would allow them to do that, but provided they would and the Board of Nursing was interested in making that change, they certainly could do so.
Also, let the record reflect that Vice Chair Ruffridge joined us at 3:20. Any other questions? Representative Ruffridge.
Now that I've been recognized, I can have a question. Yeah. Temporary licensure, and from the understanding that I've gotten through the presentation, would be done at the same time as the permanent license type. I'm still not quite gathering the reason why that would speed up anything. If both of them, so essentially I apply for a position, I apply with my permanent license type, my temporary license type, that in theory goes to the bottom of the pile, and then we work through all of them, you get to my application, and then you see my permanent license and my temporary license. And I would assume process both. Maybe one's easier than the other, and maybe you have to check a few more things. I'm just wondering why there isn't a way to expedite the temporary license portion, or maybe there is.
Through the chair to Representative Ruppridge. So in your example, it might not make as much of a difference because someone submitted both of those applications at the same time. And so we would pick it up and review an application from the individual, and then immediately the next thing that got picked up would be an additional application from that individual. And so you would have that familiarity. But many people will apply for a temporary license and then make that permanent license application at a later time. And so by that time, you know, the occupational licensing examiner has seen 50 other applications and they don't remember anything about the individual. And so it's kind of have to start at square one again. And so this way we're only receiving one application from the individual at which they could say, I'm only interested in a temporary license. And so then we don't do the work to say, dear applicant, if you want a permanent license, here are all the additional things that we need from you in order to issue that. So we save that time to review for what's missing and communicate that to the applicant, as well as not having to pick up those two pieces of paper and come back and remind ourselves again about the applicant in question.
Okay. Follow-up, if I may? Through the chair. So I understand that there will be essentially one form, the ability to potentially just check either or both boxes. Mm-hmm. But there is no expedited way to see temporary license applications at this time and probably not an intent to do so.
Through the chair to Representative Ruffridge, that is correct. So this isn't sort of the equivalent of like the TSA pre-check line where you get to jump ahead. The division is concerned that if it were structured that way, we would only see temporary applications. Like everyone would want a temporary application. Whereas right now, many people plan far enough in advance to know that they're coming to Alaska or they're going to be finishing their schooling and be able to qualify for one of these licenses so that they can make that permanent licensure application. So otherwise we can see it would sort of have the opposite of the desired impact.
Understood. Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Rupp, has there been any querying of the professional licensing boards? I know in your previous testimony you said there was, I think, 43 representing 100 and some different occupations. Has there been any survey or polling or question of them to see if they support this legislation to do this?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler. So you're correct. We have 43 professions professional areas with 125 different professions. 21 of those have professional licensing boards. We have shared the legislation with the boards. To date, we have not received questions from them or any concerns about the legislation. But no, we have not polled them beyond sharing the information.
Another question, if I may? In one of the letter from a community analysis outfit, they say that we hope that this legislation may be a stepping stone to more professional compacts in Alaska. Does the department see this as, in fact, a stepping stone to more professional compacting in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, we are certainly in general in favor of compacts, but you know each of the compacts is structured very differently, and so they really require a lot of investigation on our part to ensure that it's not going to lower the level of safety for Alaskans receiving those services, that it wouldn't make the cost for the licensees onerous, but No, in answer to your question, we don't really see this as a stepping stone, but instead an additional tool that will help us get people to work faster.
Thank you.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. Ms. Robb, how many states currently have some type of universal temporary licensure, and can you list a few of the states that do?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, there are 18 states that currently have some form of universal temporary licensure, and if you'll give me just a moment to find the right slide that has the map. Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Iowa. Oh, my geography's getting shaky. looking at shapes at a map. But that's a Pennsylvania, Vermont, New Hampshire, New Jersey. And there's a couple in the middle that are those square states that I wouldn't confidently say what they are. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mrs. Robb. We will set an amendment deadline for this bill for next week, and we'll set this aside to next Wednesday. Thank you.
Thank you.
Moving on to House Bill 87, a bill by request of the governor. Members from the Department of Revenue are here to present this bill. Please approach, put your name on the record, and begin your presentation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dale Lamani. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of Revenue. With me today, I have the PFD Director, Genevieve Wojcicki. Also, we have some folks online and in the audience that are available to address any questions for the committee. Last, we also have a special guest in the audience, former Senator and PFD Director, Anna McKinnon, who is in support of this proposed legislation. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to take this opportunity and thank the committee for giving us this opportunity to present on the proposed legislation surrounding HB 87, which is an act relating to the records checks for certain employees of the Permanent Fund Department of Revenue section relating to the PFD. Advancing to slide three, this is a pretty straightforward bill. It's more of a procedural bill. Over the last couple of years, the PFD division has made significant improvements and efforts in protecting the data of the Alaskans as it pertains to the PFD division. And this legislation is certainly an advancement towards that goal. This legislation is comprised of four key sections. Number one is to provide statutory authority to collect fingerprints for the purpose of conducting background checks on DOR employees, including the contractors that may be subject to personable identifiable information. Number two, it provides clarity and allows merchant mariners attending qualified vocational programs to qualify for an allowable absence from the state for eligibility purpose. Number three, it adds a new subsection to Alaska Statute 43.23.008 to define the term education on a full-time basis, and this is strictly for the purpose of calculating allowable absences for students receiving secondary or post-secondary education. And finally, number four is to amend AS 4323.140 Section D to allow the division to use electronic notices to levy for individuals who are subject to a court order for collection of debt. With that, Mr. Chair, I would like to transition the rest of the presentation to PFD Director Ms. Wojcicki to go through the specific sections of the bill.
Okay. Chair and committee, for the record, Genevieve Wojcicki, PFD Division Director. If you're happy for me to go through the sectional, then I'll do that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Section 1, which starts, the addition starts on page 3, line 25. It adds the DPS, Department of Public Safety, statutes to obtain a national criminal history record check to our statutes. This joins a lot of other positions that also already have background checks. That's police officers, village public safety officers, lawyers, brokers, to name a few, teachers. This would just add us to that section of statute. Section 2 starts on page 3, line 29 of the bill. It adds Alaska Statute 43.23, and this is just the section that allows us to actually run that criminal history check. And then Section 5 of the same bill, which starts on page 8, line 7, is the last part of the background check. and that adds subsection 12, which is the actual process that Department of Public Safety uses to run the criminal check. So that's sections 1, 2, and 5. Sorry, it's broken out, but that's the way law drafted it. Section 3 is the next section, and that section is merchant mariners. So as the Deputy Commissioner had stated, it allows those students that are training to be merchant mariners an allowable absence while they're in that training. Once you become a merchant mariner, that's already an allowable absence, but this allows those students that are in training to become merchant mariners. And then section 4, it adds the definition of education on a full-time basis. In the bill, this is page 6, section 4, starting at line 9. It's a simple clarification to the statute, but it's just adding a definition of what students are on a full-time basis, and it allows those that are not coming home for fall break or winter break or spring break to still be on an allowable absence, and we're not going to count it against you. The last section, which is section 6, electronic notice of a levy. This is just amending our current statute by adding the two words electronic notice. Right now we have to send all levy notices by mail, and a lot of Alaskans prefer electronic notification of these levy of garnishments, and we could get it out the door faster and to them sooner if we could do this by email, but Department of Law states that we need to add this by statute, and so we can't just email folks. We need to have it in statute. And the other sections, which are 7, 8, and 9, are just transitional regulation language and effective date language. And that's the bill.
Thank you. Are there any questions? No. Okay. Seeing no other questions, we will set this bill aside while we prepare the committee substitute. Moving on to House Bill 35 from Representative Rauscher. Please approach. Put your name on the record. Oh, is he here, actually? I'll take a five-minute at ease. Okay, we're back on the record. Representative Rauscher, just put your name on the record and begin your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is George Rauscher, Representative, District 29. I'd like to thank the Chair of the Labor and Commerce Committee and the members of its committee here for hearing HB 35, an act relating to the Certificate of Need Program for health care facilities and providing for an effective date. House Bill 35 repeals the Certificate of Need program in Alaska and provides for an effective date of July 1st, 2024. The Certificate of Need program was first mandated by the federal government in 1974 and in 1987 was repealed federally. 13 states have since repealed the program at the state level, and House Bill 35 intends to make Alaska the next one. Certificate of Need programs were intended to reduce health care costs, improve access to health care, and regulate and limit the entry and supply of medical services and facilities. However, health care systems have evolved from a fee-for-service system, which lacked an incentive to lower prices, to a prospective payment system today. Certificate of Need laws over the last 40-plus years have stifled competition, created a new barrier to healthcare facilities and care for healthcare consumers, and prevented the free market forces which improve the quality and lower the cost of healthcare. Alaska's Certificate of Need program poses a substantial threat to the proper performance of healthcare markets and services. I appreciate the support for passage of HB 35. If I'd like to turn my or your attention to my staff member, Craig Valdez. He's going to give you the sectional, and we'll be ready for any questions after that.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Craig Valdez, staff to you, Representative Rauscher. If you're ready, I'll go through the sectional.
Yeah, go ahead. Thank you.
All right. Section 1. This section changes the statute reference to healthcare facility definitions. Section 2, AS12.55.155C, subsection 36, subsection A. This section repeals the old definition and redefines healthcare facility. Section 3, AS18.20.400, subsection C. This section removes the old statute that defines residential psychiatric treatment center and clarifies the language for an easier read. Section 4, AS18.20.400. This section adds a new subsection that defines residential psychiatric treatment centers. Section 5, AS18.20.499, subsection 2. This amends the section by replacing AS18.07.111 with AS18.20.400D and clarifying the language for an easier read. Section 6, AS18.26.220. This paragraph is amended by replacing the title of the subsection and removing all requirements for the certificate of need. Section 7. This amends the definition of healthcare facility as defined in AS18.20.400D instead of AS18.07.111. Section 8 covers quite a few subsections, and it repeals some, as well as AS47.80.140, subsection B, are repealed. Section 9, Section 4, Chapter 275, the SLA 1976, is repealed. And Section 10, the uncodified law of the state of Alaska, is amended by adding a new section that states the Department of Family and Community Services may not take action on or after the effective date to revoke or modify a certificate of need before the effective date. And Section 11 simply sets an effective date for this bill. And I would like to note that the fiscal note at zero right now, with a zero fiscal note from Department of Health and Social Services. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the sponsor? Representative Trox.
Thank you. Through the chair, I have long been a supporter of repealing the Certificate of Need program for all the reasons that you mentioned. I don't recall if it was last year or the year before or the year before that. This effort has been in place for quite a long time. But at about that time, I believe it was the Department of Health, Department of Health, Medicaid Services, that said that this would cost tens of millions of dollars in additional Medicaid expenses because the Medicaid rate setting allows people to write off, no, excuse me, does, I forget, allows people to write off the capital expenditures in an oddball way. In other words, it isn't correct to say that the healthcare industry is a free market in Alaska. Have you checked with the healthcare or with the Medicaid Services Department to see why they have apparently changed their mind on the fiscal?
For the record, Representative Rauscher, through the chair, Representative Prox, I have not looked into that question, but I can tell you that I don't believe that it's true. And our fiscal notes prove it. But just to give you an example of the reality of what we're talking about here, if you look in Delta, they've been trying to build a hospital for quite a while. And they've been The number that I was last quoted when I ran this bill 4 years ago was $35,000 to have a certificate of need looked into to be able to get one and acquire one. And since then, the cost has even gone up. So this, for areas which are for hundreds of miles around, could be the only health care facility, something like a certificate of need only bogs them down trying to acquire enough funding to build a hospital or a clinic or any kind of health care in that area, which they lack to begin with. So I think what you're saying is the reality was found out to be false, and that's the way it is where it is now.
Okay.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Rauscher. I think on the fiscal note, I had some of the same questions as Representative Frogs. More accurate description of the fiscal note would be an indeterminate fiscal note. Wouldn't that be correct?
For the record, my name is Craig Valdez, staff representative Rauscher. That is correct, just in the direct costs that they're estimating would be that, though the knock-on effects is a little harder to estimate going forward.
Thank you. And follow up, if I may, different question. So one of the issues surrounding this, and again, going back to the question from Representative Prox, is that there is a indeterminate amount of potential cost increases, particularly to state Medicaid, that we would need to really plan for. Second issue is in some of the instances, particularly the reference for Delta and the ability to build a healthcare clinic or emergency services in that area, one of the issues that presents itself is actually the lack of ability to tax property in that area in order to build a hospital, similar to other areas in the state where the borough or municipality is the clinic owner and it uses tax revenue in order to support it. I'm not certain as though the certificate of need is the only barrier for some of these rural healthcare facilities. Is that in your estimation as well? Is that part of that problem?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, for the record, to Representative Ruffridge, I believe there are lots of costs that are incurred in building a clinic and a hospital, and I believe that this is one of the hurdles that they would have to overcome, and it's a needless hurdle. There are many hurdles that you have to do or have to overcome to build a clinic or a hospital, but to throw another $45,000 at them for something that's only going to prove to be positive and take more money away from the purchase of whatever it is, land or materials or architectural costs or whatever else is going to incur is actually the argument there.
And then for the record, Craig Wadez, staff to Representative Rauscher, I think for the first part of your question, we have invited testimony from Jamie Kavanaugh from the Institute of Justice that could possibly speak more to the first part of that if they should be available.
Thank you. We'll take Representative Carrick's question, and then we'll do invite testimony. Representative Carrick.
So on the fiscal note through the chair to Representative Rauscher, it says that the threshold for requiring a certificate of need is $1.5 million. Is that the startup cost average for acquiring a certificate of need to open a healthcare facility, or do you know what that number is or what that ballpark is for the initial certificate of need acquisition?
Representative Carrick, through the chair, I believe that is the total cost of a facility, that if the total cost of facility to be built goes over that number, they would require the certificate of need.
I see. Thank you. To follow up through the chair. And I guess what are some of the additional costs required? You have mentioned that there's additional costs by having this program in place for having that startup Do you know what some of those additional costs are in dollar amounts?
It depends on the clinic you're building.
To the chair, Representative Carrick, that would probably depend on the facility being built. I don't have specific examples at this time, though we could probably find that out if you would like to.
Yeah, just through the chair, just briefly, I think that it would be valuable using the Delta example, perhaps, of what is the additional cost that's required to open a healthcare facility as compared to the overall startup costs, right? So in my mind, it costs an awful lot to start any sort of healthcare facility, whether it's a dialysis treatment facility or a hospital. And I'm curious just how much that cost is, because as a committee, I think we'll have to compare that cost and the burden it places on potential startup and facility operations to the potential lost cost in Medicaid and the additional burdens it might place on existing facilities. So to me, that seems like a valuable piece of information. And if the chair would indulge me, I have one other question that's unrelated.
Go ahead.
I see that there aren't backup documents at this point. Are there any existing healthcare facilities that have in the past offered their support of repeal of certificate of need, or has that been a discussion with some of the current hospital or healthcare facilities in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, for the record, to Representative Carrick, I do know of people who work at clinics who have supported the idea of repealing the certificate of need, and I do know of clinics that would like to see the certificate of need not be a barrier for them. We can get that list for you if you'd like.
Yeah, thank you. That would be helpful.
Thank you. So it looks like we have Jamie Kavanaugh online with the Institute of Justice. So we will take invited testimony. Please state your name for the record, and you can begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Jamie Kavanaugh. I'm an attorney with the Institute for Justice. And for decades, the Institute for Justice has been working to end certificate of need laws through litigation and legislation. So today I'd like to share some findings from a national report I published on certificate of need, and then also explain how various government agencies at different levels support repealing certificate of need, and then I'll be happy to answer questions. So in 2020, I put together a comprehensive survey of certificate of need laws around the country and reported on how states adjusted their con programs in response to the pandemic. The pandemic really laid bare the existing problems with con laws. If they actually created greater access to healthcare, as many proponents argue, then we would have seen that states would have needed more during the pandemic. But the exact opposite was true. Most of the states with con programs were forced to quickly suspend them to allow hospitals to add beds and services, and this included Alaska. And this problem isn't limited to COVID. As cases of RSV soared this fall, some states needed to suspend con laws again to give healthcare providers flexibility to respond to their patients' needs in real time. It's doctors and patients who should be deciding when care is needed, not bureaucrats. Instead of waiting for the next emergency and then reacting, we should be allowing healthcare providers flexibility now. So another key finding from my report is that certificate of need laws don't prevent rural hospital closures. That's an argument that we hear a lot, and that was even brought up in the Senate hearing on the companion bill. But Alabama, Oregon, Tennessee, and Washington are all states with certificate of need laws. However, they all exclude rural areas from their CON programs to encourage hospitals and other healthcare facilities to expand into rural areas. Moreover, some of the country's most rural states have no CON laws at all, states like Idaho, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wyoming. and two other states, Utah and Colorado, haven't had a single rural hospital closure since at least 2005, and neither of those states have con laws. So it can't be that certificate of need is what's preventing rural hospital closures. The second, I'd like to share some findings from various government actors and agencies that all agree that certificate of need laws are harmful and should be repealed. For example, North Carolina State Treasurer Dale Folwell filed a friend of the court brief in an ongoing Institute for Justice lawsuit that's challenging the constitutionality of the certificate of need laws there. And Treasurer Folwell used his brief to explain why certificate of need laws lead to increased healthcare spending by taxpayers who are responsible in part for covering the annual $4 billion cost of the state's teacher and employee healthcare plan. He also noted his concern that hospitals were abusing their nonprofit status. He said, quote, con laws contribute to consolidated healthcare monopolies by distorting market power in favor of large institutional hospitals. This illegal distortion of market power then results in higher prices, lower quality, and less availability of healthcare services. In turn, large institutional hospitals create incredible excess revenue while failing to earn their tax-exempt status through the provision of charity care and engage in business practices harmful to North Carolinians. And the same problems exist in Alaska. Studies show that con laws do not lead to increased charity care, but they do insulate hospitals from costly competition. And it isn't just state government that recognizes the problems with certificate of need. The Federal Trade Commission and the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice have been consistent for decades in supporting certificate of need repeal. In 2019, they submitted testimony in support of con repeal here in Alaska. And while citing to peer-reviewed research, they made three points that I'd like to share. The first was that empirical evidence consistently indicates that increases in hospital market concentration lead to increases in the price of hospital care. Second was that recent work shows that hospitals faced with a more competitive environment have better management practices, and that repealing or narrowing certificate of need laws can reduce per patient costs of healthcare. And third is that certificate of need proponents concede that con laws allow incumbent providers to earn greater profits than they would in a competitive environment. They argue that in theory, these providers use profits to cross-subsidize charity care. But, quote, the evidence does not show that con laws advance that goal, end quote. So the empirical evidence is clear that the claims that con proponents make are unsupported. Instead, all the evidence shows that certificate of need laws lead to higher costs, lower quality, and decreased access to care. So I'd urge your support for this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mrs. Kavanaugh. Any questions? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. To the chair, Ms. Kavanaugh, thanks for speaking to us. Not being an expert on healthcare policies, but knowing that Alaska's healthcare system, because of our extended geographical spread and small population relative, do you have any special insight as to how the certificate of need laws have affected, how they have been played out in Alaska that might be different than elsewhere in the lower 48, which is what we call the rest of you guys?
Right. Thank you. Through the chair. There's empirical research that shows that states without certificate of need laws have more hospitals, more hospital beds, more healthcare facilities, more dialysis centers, more nursing homes, more imaging equipment. So there would be more access to healthcare in Alaska. That wouldn't reduce the problem that you have with your geographical spread, but having the ability to open more healthcare facilities in rural areas would increase access to care. And something I wanted to mention, the questions earlier from Representative Harris about the costs associated with applying for a certificate of need. What we see around the country is that many healthcare facilities and healthcare entrepreneurs give up without really even trying, because they know that to start the certificate of need process, your direct competitors come in and argue against you in the certificate of need process and argue that you shouldn't be granted a certificate and that your services aren't needed. So, you know, time and time again, we know that people aren't even applying for the certificates. They're giving up without even trying to open. So we know that there would be more healthcare services available if certificate of need laws weren't in place.
Go
ahead.
Thank you. Not to speaking for or against the bill, and they haven't analyzed it thoroughly yet. I still don't quite understand exactly that, to the extent to which certificate of need laws apply in Alaska with the occasional concentrations of population and very little intercourse between them. I'm just curious to see how CONs play out here versus states elsewhere where there's roads and more competition. I'm curious to find out, should certificate of need laws be repealed in Alaska, would that result in the construction of more hospitals? Given the population and markets, I don't think so. Maybe more clinics and surgery centers. But again, I remain to be persuaded to get more information about how CONs work in Alaska or their absence would benefit Alaskans. No question.
Okay. Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, you mentioned a couple of studies specific to Alaska. Could you make those studies available to us, send them to us in the links, whatever?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you, Mrs. Kavanoff. Any other questions for the bill sponsor? No? Okay, so seeing no other questions, we will set this bill aside for a later date. That concludes our business today. We will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 4:10 p.m.